This week on Texas Scorecard Radio in the news, we'll talk about a split between Texas' two senators on an important judicial nominee. We'll also take a look and see whether there's a blue wave on the horizon. In our interview, we talked to Aaron Harris with Direct Action Texas to talk about a doctor in North Texas who's killing people for profit and a cover-up by a local hospital. And in this week's commentary, Michael Quinn Sullivan cracks the whip. It's no time for Congress to be lazy. Welcome back to this week's Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios. We'll get started with this week's news, big news. Texas' two senators headed in very different directions on a certain judicial nominee. No, we're not talking about the Supreme Court, but talking about a different Court of Appeals judge. Very interesting fight for that. I brought in Kerry Cheshire, Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. Thanks for joining me, Kerry.
Glad to be here, Tony.
So you wrote an article about this, Senator Ted Cruz, Senator John Cornyn, coming out different ways on this nominee. Tell us a little bit about what went on.
Right. Well, it's really been an undercurrent that's really gained steam throughout President Trump's presidency of really appointing a lot of judges to the bench. And one of these judges that recently got appointed was Mark Bennett, the former Attorney General for Hawaii, who Trump nominated and was confirmed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, this is not the Supreme Court, but it's the court just underneath it. There's appellate courts all across the nation. This one meets in California.
This is the infamously liberal Ninth Circuit out in San Francisco, you know. This is the court that, if Trump sneezes, they say he didn't say God bless you correctly.
Right. This is the court that said that his travel ban was
unconstitutional. Or if he sneezes and he says God bless you, that's an establishment of religion.
Exactly. and it's one that, you know, said that his travel ban was unconstitutional. It was later overturned by the Supreme Court. But anyway, he nominated this guy named Mark Bennett, a former Hawaiian attorney general, that conservatives actually ended up coming out against. While he was attorney general for Hawaii, he ruled in against the side of gun owners in the famous D.C. versus Heller case. He had, you know, spoken in favor of gay marriage, something that conservatives weren't in favor of at all, and was really exposed during his nomination hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee by Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
Yeah, the interesting thing here is this thing went all the way through the process. At the end of the day, a majority of Republicans in the Senate voted against this nominee. He relied on the Democrat votes in order to get placed on the Ninth Circuit.
Absolutely. 27 members of the 51-member strong Republican caucus in the United States Senate voted against him. There were a number that were absent. I mean, could have ended up being close to 30. But John Cornyn, Senate Republican leadership, voted with the Democrats in order to confirm this guy to the court.
Let's walk through a little bit of some of Cruz's criticism. You mentioned the Heller case. As people may remember, Cruz, before he was running for Senate and doing all those things, he was Texas Solicitor General. And so he was actually involved in Heller, this very important case to secure the Second Amendment right. Basically, D.C. had banned guns, and Heller challenged it with the backing of conservative voices, and Cruz and then Attorney General Greg Abbott come in for the Second Amendment. At the same time, this other guy, he's fighting against it.
He's fighting against them. He also fought against conservatives in Citizens United, a very, very big, important free speech win that the Supreme Court litigated a couple years ago.
Yeah, and so this guy was, on behalf of the state of Hawaii, filing briefs and joining briefs at the Supreme Court saying, hey, we are against free speech. We want the court to continue to regulate and restrict the First Amendment. Thankfully, he lost, but now he's on the Ninth Circuit.
Absolutely. And, you know, just to quote Senator Cruz on the issue, he said, taking the position in the Heller case that the Second Amendment protects no individual right to keep and bear arms whatsoever is, in my judgment, an extreme position. And it absolutely is. It's a travesty that this guy got nominated to the court. It's a travesty that he got confirmed to the court. The good news is he's 65, and we don't anticipate he'll be on there very long.
Sure.
But it's very concerning, and it shows that the public needs to be vigilant and aware of everyone who's appointed to these courts.
Yeah, I think that's right. We've got to keep an eye on these things and know just because President Trump has a good track record with his appointments for judges, it's not necessarily always going to be the case, and we need to be holding our senators' feet to the fire to go do their job, investigate these guys, and vote against them whenever their views are out of step with, you know, what we would want and what the president would want.
Absolutely, Tony, and I think citizens all across the nation have a good opportunity now with the Supreme Court justice coming up, and citizens here in the state of Texas have a great opportunity with two senators on the Judiciary Committee to really make sure that we get strong constitutional judges.
Well, I appreciate your reporting on it. Thanks for joining me, Kerry.
Thanks, Tony.
Next, I want to turn to Brandon Waltons, Capitol Bureau Chief for Texas Scorecard. The summer campaign finance reports are out,
yes,
and we've been here crunching the numbers. And as I say to listeners, you know, it's not so important who raises more money. It's not inherently important, but it is kind of these tea leaves that we can read to try and see what's going to happen in November, what's shaping up. And so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what some of the trends we're seeing. What's going on? Is there a blue wave a coming?
Yes, and you know, it's been a while since we've gotten to look at these financial reports, but of course the semi-annual reports were due, and they came out this week, and so we've been kind of looking through them. And you know, for all the pundits and all the liberals talking about a blue wave coming to Texas, that Democrats are going to take back this state, that they haven't won a statewide office since 1994, if you use the financial reports that have come out as an indication, doesn't look like that's coming to fruition, especially, yes.
Top of the ticket's looking really weak.
No, exactly. And so you have Governor Abbott outraising his opponent, Democrat Lupe Valdez, by just a huge, huge magnitude. Abbott, of course, has a $30 million war chest. Lupe has just a little over a couple hundred thousand dollars.
Yeah, which is like not enough to run a state house race or something. Likewise, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, Ken Paxton, the other statewide's doing really well, blowing out their opponents too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, Abbott's not the only statewide that's doing well. Both Paxton and Dan Patrick put up impressive numbers against their Democrat opponents in this report as well.
What about the kind of Senate races? There's a couple Senate races that people have an eye on for November.
Yeah, so there's two Senate races. There's SD-10 that's up in the Fort Worth area. That's held by Connie Burton.
It was just a seat. The old Wendy Davis seat, right?
Formerly held by Wendy Davis. She's got a Democrat opponent. A lot of Democrat eyes are on that one. But even in that case, I mean, Connie has about four times as much cash on hand as does Beverly Powell, her Democrat opponent. On the other side of the Metroplex up there, Democrats also looking at taking the seat currently held by Senator Don Huffines. They're having a similar problem there. Don Huffines, of course, has around $1 million, and his Democrat has about a quarter of that.
Yeah. Now, there was some reporting. It looks like the Democrats focusing a lot of their attention on congressional races, and I think that makes sense. I mean, it's a they're an anti-Trump party. That's
sure.
Pretty much the one uniting principle on the left right now is we're anti-Trump.
Right.
Anything Trump does is bad. And so obviously they'd be focused on congressional races. So there are a handful of these congressional challengers outraising some of the incumbents.
Yeah.
And so we're seeing those reports come out. A little different schedule on those, but basically the same. But really the big battleground, you look at Texas politics and the legislature, you're looking at Dallas County. A lot of things going on there. What's the situation there?
Well, you have a number of races that some would consider competitive up there. But even then, in those cases, the Republican generally is outraising, by some level, outraising their Democrat opponent, despite all this enthusiasm we're hearing and talking about on the left.
Yeah, so basically what we're seeing is it'll be close, but
right.
You know, it's even. It's even, not some kind of blowout.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Well, I appreciate you crunching the numbers and looking at it, and thanks for coming in and joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's news digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
This week on the program, we have our friend Aaron Harris with Direct Action Texas joining us. Thanks for coming in, Aaron.
Hey, Tony. Thanks for having me, as always.
Yeah, well, you know, this is now the second time this year that we're covering a story about doctors in hospitals killing people for profit, basically. We had a story earlier this year, I think, out of Collin County, and now you've identified something going on in Tarrant County with a doctor who is was killing people and a cover-up related to it. Big news. I wanted to talk about kind of what's going on and what we're learning.
Yeah, well, again, thanks for having me on. And the story has caused a lot of reaction here in Tarrant County, which,
oh, I bet,
of course, is Fort Worth for those listeners that aren't familiar with county names. But I was approached a while back by a source inside the hospital telling me of a doctor. Her name is Therese Duane, and white female, who came to JPS. JPS is our county-owned hospital, so this is a taxpayer-funded hospital. And she came to JPS back in 2014. She is the director of surgery and one of the heads of trauma. She was also president of the physicians group. So for those of you who don't know, physicians actually work for a third-party group that subs to the hospital. Anyhow, so our source...
So she was pretty high up, senior, yeah.
Very high up, that's correct. And her husband is the head of research for the hospital. I mean, these are not just some line staff doctors.
Right.
So so our source tells us originally that she was pulling the plug on patients illegally, okay? And so let's qualify that real quick. To pull a plug on a patient, you have to have family consent, or you have to go through what's called an ethics panel.
Right.
There's a two-day notification for an ethics panel, which is a panel the doctors get together and hear the case. And if they choose or decide to pull the plug, there's a 10-day notice after that to the family.
We've had enough. I mean, we've had Texas Right to Life onto the program to talk about that procedure, which is hugely flawed. But we've kind of, you know, if listeners are out there and they're going, hey, I want to learn more about that, go back into the podcast, go to the archives. You can find our interviews with Texas Right to Life on pulling the plug. I think I talked to Emily Cook about it. But, you know, it's basically a death panel. But it's authorized under state law. And obviously the family can make family decisions. Those are the ways. That's what
One of the things they have is an option to find another facility and move them.
Okay? Right.
And the point here is none of these things were followed. And so this doctor... I'll give you the most famous example, which is the one the hospital thinks is the only one we have. Doctor, this family guy was in an auto accident on a Thursday. Saturday, he's on life support. Saturday afternoon, evening, 5:30, they have a family meeting with the hospital. A couple things were decided to discuss in that meeting, the biggest of which is they would keep him on life support for another 7 days. At that point, the family would make the decision on what to do. The family's Catholic. Under no circumstances they want to pull the plug.
Right.
Okay. The family stays there that night. They, at some point that night, leave. The father stays with the son, who's the victim here, overnight. Problem is, father doesn't speak any English. Okay. This doctor, Dr. Duane, walks in at 6 a.m. on Sunday. Now, this was Easter Sunday. Okay. 4-1, April 1st, she walks in at 6 o'clock, tells the father, who doesn't speak English, that she has an order signed by doctors to terminate care on his son, proceeds to terminate care. He's declared dead at 6:26, 26 minutes later.
Wow.
All the while, the father is confused. He felt bullied. He felt intimidated, had no idea what happened. So in that situation, 12 hours prior to this, they were promised 7 more days. That was the agreement,
right?
And they also discussed, for example, if it came down to that point, the family would have an opportunity to come in and say goodbye, last rites be administered. They're Catholic. Obviously, that's a big thing. All of that was denied, not to mention the following the law. So my original source tells me... So my original source tells me that there's about 10 of these from her... over a 10 or 12 month period. We've had, since my original source, I started digging into this, we've talked to other people, we have had multiple, mostly medical, but also some administrative staff, confirm that she did at least 3 of these in March alone.
Wow.
We are aware of a couple of them. Since our story broke, we've had a total of 5 families reach out to us.
So the bigger part of the story, even beyond the action, or maybe not the bigger part of the story, I mean, this is a huge story. I mean, anytime you have a doctor who's, you know, violating the law to kill patients, it's a big deal. But arguably the bigger part of the story is there's a cover-up. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that's – I'm glad you went there, because a lot of times we can get bogged down in the fact that somebody's killing people. We forget the fact that she was aided and abetted, if you will.
Correct.
What do I mean by that? So on Easter, April 1st, in the prior day, March 31st, some of her fellow doctors confronted her about this, okay? And some of the nurses didn't confront, but they talked to the other doctors. And she was confronted by some doctors on – April 2nd, April 3rd, either that Monday or Tuesday, I'm not sure which day yet, there was a they have a physician board that oversees the physicians and if they do something wrong or questionable, whatever. So the physician board met to discuss the fact that this doctor has been pulling plugs on people. And they suggested she take 30 days off while they figure out what to do. She said, "I'm y'all's boss, screw you, I'm staying here." She continued to practice as normal, showing up every day. The hospital went on to do nothing and continue to allow her to practice. When my sources started coming to me, she was practicing normally. It wasn't until after we started submitting very specific open records requests. And I have a history of exposing stories with this hospital, so they know who I am.
Right.
Once the general counsel and the CEO found out that I knew, they finally have removed her from the physician group. She doesn't practice at the hospital in the physician group. However, she still has admitting privileges at the hospital to this day. So it's a fine line of them saying, well, we let her go from our group, but she's free to get her own business.
So you know, you recently came out with this story on your website, and this became news. And then there was a reaction from the hospital leadership at their next meeting. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so last Thursday, one of the board members, I released a story on a Wednesday. That Thursday, the very next day, there was a board meeting. And the CEO, his name's Robert Early, who's, by the way, the highest paid bureaucrat in Tarrant County. Guy's never run a medical industry in his life, but he was the chief of staff for our previous county judge. So he made him hospital administrator, CEO, pulling down a whopping $850,000 taxpayer dollars a year. I digress. So on Thursday, one of the board members, after his report, the CEO's report, asked him about this story breaking. And he took the typical approach, which was to basically try to malign the messenger, saying, well, it's not real media that's broken this story. It's a non-issue. There allegedly was one instance, but we dealt with it. But it's still a non-issue. It's not worthy of us responding to. A couple of the other board members jumped on board and said, well, we need to have a response for our constituents. He blew the whole thing off. And so that's their typical MO when these things happen. Yeah. Is to lie just say it. The messenger is bad.
Shoot at the messenger and lie about
it. Shoot the messenger. That's right. Now, let me get back to your point, though, that you made about the cover-up. You know, since the issue here is I'm accusing or I'm retelling the story that it's been told to me of her pulling the plug on multiple patients. And by the way, we've interviewed these families, and we're going to be breaking this out in a series. But since my story broke, my original story, where we didn't name any names, either of victims or doctors, we're going to start doing that over the next week or two. I've had a bunch of people come out of the woodwork, both anonymously and on the record. And I want to read to you a statement. So you asked me about the doctor. So, you know, this is from a surgical source, somebody in the medical surgical staff that came to me anonymously, and I'm going to read this for you. Her agreement with the hospital was that she was dismissed in lieu of a formal complaint being placed with the Texas Medical Board. Without a formal complaint, she is now free to seek to practice elsewhere and be dangerous elsewhere. The hospital is complicit in any further malpractice she performs elsewhere by sweeping this under the rug. And that's one of the big problems here.
Absolutely.
You have a behavior pattern that we see across government, by the way, you know, whether it be schools, you know, we talked prior to this interview about, You know, there's been stories the last few years about public schools doing what's called passing the trash.
That's right, passing the trash.
When they have a bad teacher administrator who's molesting kids, they simply pass them to another school district, right? That's exactly what this is, a medical passing of the trash.
Well, you see this so frequently in government and in politics, where the hiring person doesn't want the negative publicity of having a problem. And so what do? Well, they let somebody go quietly. They feel like they have to take some action to, you know, it's CYA. I mean, they're not necessarily doing it for the right reasons, but they'll go ahead and fire the person, but then they'll quietly do that, and they won't alert anybody. You saw this with sexual harassment. You've seen it with the passing the trash problem in the schools. And now you're seeing it, you know, again, I would say passing the trash. This woman is arguably, allegedly, a murderer. And you have a hospital say, well, okay, we're going to wipe our hands clean of her. But, she's going to end up, she's going to land somewhere. And this is something I don't understand. Has this gone to the district attorney? Has this gone to law enforcement? What's the situation there?
Yeah, great question. So we have the challenge with this story is our sources did not give us any identifying information of the victims.
Okay.
So we had to do old-fashioned investigative work. We have since found several families, okay? And what we found was they have a commonality, which is they're minority. Very low income minority. Okay, yeah. is the
well, and that's why the hospital is killing these people, because they can't pay. You know, if you can pay, they'll take your money. But
that's right.
That's that's why they're victims.
So I mean, you said it. So what we have done is we have introduced them to an attorney, and here's the bigger problem. Tony, is the Texas legislature, in all of its lack of wisdom, has literally exempted public hospitals from liability. Okay, yep. So the families cannot.
They're going to run up against sovereign immunity. And right. it's a knife fight just to get into court.
And it extends to the employees and agents and contractors of the hospital. So. Civilly, there's no remedy or recourse for these victims who have lost family members. There is criminally, potentially. So what we're working on now, and I say we, really the lawyer that I introduced them to, is working with the families to get complaints filed with Texas Medical Board and several other agencies. And then, hopefully from there, the DA will also follow up complaint with the DA, and hopefully from there, the DA will look into it.
Yeah. This is textbook out of criminal law 101. You learn in law school, and I'm an attorney, and you learn in law school, the guy's plummeting off the side of the building. If you shoot him at, the 45th floor, and then he goes splat on the pavement, you've still committed a murder. I mean, so people should not kid themselves, oh, well, this guy didn't have a chance. Oh, well, this person killed somebody. And it's really important that listeners understand that.
Well, not only that, Tony. So one of the families I spoke to has a close family friend who, after a car accident, he was in a coma for 6 months. And today he walks and talks. And they looked upon that story that happened to a close friend of theirs, and it gave them hope for their family member.
And there are many stories like that.
And their faith and their hope was such that they were not going to agree to pull the plug. And who is a one-person doctor to override that? Like, what arrogance on her part to come in and play God?
Well, it's so clear that there's horrible problems here. There's so much more to get into. We're running out of time. Before we finish, tell listeners, where can they get the story? Where can they learn more about your work at Direct Action Texas? And tell folks where they can learn a little more.
Sure, I appreciate that. So directactiontexas.com is our website. This story right now is at the top of the page, so you can get that. You can also obviously sign up for our emails. I will say we don't send out emails very often. but we do when we have something we need to talk about. So we're actually haven't even emailed this story out yet, because we're going to do that with our second one coming out, where we name names. But sign up for our emails. Check out directactiontexas.com. And then, of course, our Facebook page. Anytime we post an article, we'll post it on our Facebook page. So Direct Action Texas on Facebook. That's where you can find me.
All right. Well, thank you, Aaron. Thank you for your reporting on this. It's a really important work, and certainly not the end of the story.
Appreciate it, Tony. Thanks for having me on.
Have you heard about the Texas Torchbearers program sponsored by Empower Texans? It's a program that makes activism fun and exciting. You can sign up at texastorchbearers.com. There, you can learn about the easiest and most effective ways to engage your government officials to hold them accountable. As a Texas Torchbearer, you can compete with your friends and fellow activists across the state by watching a live leaderboard, as well as seeing what others are doing across the great state of Texas. You can even earn cool prizes like an awesome pair of custom-fit cowboy boots with the Texas Torchbearers logo on it, or a multitude of other prizes. For example, we just gave away an awesome custom Glock handgun. With the Texas Torchbearers program, it's even easier to make a difference. Everyone should sign up today at texastorchbearers.com. That's texastorchbearers with an S, .com.
Speaking of judges earlier, it's important that Congress doesn't dilly-dally. They need to schedule votes on Trump's nominees to the federal courts. Michael Quinn Sullivan tells us more in this week's commentary.
Senate Republicans are taking too many victory laps for their confirmation of Justice Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court, but they haven't done enough to fill all the remaining judicial vacancies. I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan with this week's Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary. All the news these last 2 weeks have focused on the selection of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to be the next Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Sorry, guys, but 18 months of doing better than your Republican predecessors is no time for a victory celebration. Yes, they have filled 20-some vacancies, but a lot remains to be done. Unfortunately, the Senate floor, controlled by Mitch McConnell and Texas's John Cornyn, is sitting on 49 federal judge nominees passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. This is unconscionable. Of special note, Texas Senators John Cornyn and Ted Cruz both serve on the Judiciary Committee. There's no good reason for Mr. Cornyn not to be moving these nominations forward. According to SupremeCourt.gov, each term, approximately 7,000 to 8,000 new cases are filed in the Supreme Court. This is a substantially larger volume of cases than was presented to the court in the last century. In the 1950 term, for example, the Supreme Court received only 1,195 new cases. Even as recently as 1975, it received only 3,900 cases. Plenary review with oral arguments by attorneys is currently granted in about 80 of those cases each term. The Founding Fathers would have never approved of all the attention one Supreme Court vacancy receives and the power they have once confirmed, while ignoring the lower courts. Yes, it's the Senate's duty to get the Supreme Court nominations handled and handled correctly, but at the same time, they must be addressing the other pending federal judicial nominations. Remember, the lower courts handle the overwhelming bulk of the caseload and are the final say on most matters for most people. Those judgeships may not be as sexy to Senators Cornyn and McConnell, but the vacancies and accompanying delays have a negative effect on the real people seeking justice. It's hard to understand why a Republican president with a Republican Senate majority has 13 federal judge nominations pending since January, 6 since February, 4 each in March and April, 9 since May, and now 13 since June. The United States Senate should not stand in another recess until there are no vacancies in the federal judiciary. Ending the vacancies will help conservatives begin to peel away the 80-year activist agenda of the progressive left to shape laws through the judiciary instead of elections. Since FDR's court-packing schemes in the 1930s, the left has fought a war of personal destruction against conservative judges, while the Republican establishment has told us they're fighting for us while sipping tea with liberal senators Joe Kennedy and Joe Biden. No more victory laps, no more vacancies. Taxpayers deserve answers to the Senate's inaction on 49 federal judges. More than that, taxpayers deserve action. With this Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan.
Thanks for listening. That's the end of the program. Join us back here next week for another episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. We'll be right back.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.